Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. What does it mean when a food bank starts to look less like charity and more like infrastructure? A canary in the coal mine, perhaps. Not a stopgap, not a temporary response. Something system level, something that grows as the system itself frays. In this episode, Neil Hetherington walks us through that shift from the inside. As CEO of the Daily Bread Food Bank in Toronto, he's not just responding to demand, he's mapping it, forecasting it, and in many ways revealing the deeper architecture of food insecurity in one of the wealthiest cities in the world. What emerges is rather uncomfortable. Food banks were never meant to become permanent institutions, and yet they've evolved into highly sophisticated logistical systems, moving massive volumes of food, coordinating thousands of volunteers, using data and AI to anticipate need. They're efficient, they're effective, and their very effectiveness risks normalizing the conditions that make them necessary. But that's only part of the issue. Because beneath the operations, beneath the policy failures, there's something else holding it all together. Culture. Not as branding or messaging, but as a lived system of values. Dignity, choice, respect. That shape how people are served and how people show up to serve. In a context defined by scarcity, culture becomes the difference between a transaction and a relationship. This episode sits in that tension, between failure and ingenuity, between emergency response and a permanent system, between logistics and care. And in that space, a harder question begins to take form. If food banks have become essential infrastructure, what does that say about the systems we've built and the ones, quite frankly, that we've abandoned? Speaking of systems we've built, a reminder about our crowdsourcing project, commons.thefutureherd.ca. It's a way to add interactivity to this podcast, and it's something you can do while you're listening, so go check it out right now while we tune in to our chat with Neil. Neil, welcome to the Future Herd.
Really glad, really grateful to be here.
So the first question I love to throw at my guests, I'm calling it my Rorschach test, is what does the future mean to you?
The future means to me, it's a very big question. And it's very hard. You know, on the one side, data right now says things aren't quite as good as they used to be. Certainly in the food bank, now we're serving 1 in 10 Torontonians gets their food from the Daily Bread Food Bank, and that's atrocious. And that you have all these concerns and anxiety about AI and the future of work and what that's going to mean. And so that's the dark side. But we all need sort of the hopey changey stuff. And on the hopey changey side of things, I prefer to live with optimism and say, you know, are there opportunities for us to recalibrate so that AI is doing things that, you know, we don't need to spend time doing so that we can spend more time with loved ones. Maybe I'm being way too optimistic, but that's my sincere hope.
Well, and we do try to do the hopey feel-good stuff here on the Future Herd, but with the sobriety of kind of assess the challenges and some of the, to use a phrase I'm fond of, the polycrises that seem to be facing us. But before we get into that, I do want to kind of do the usual biography or lore piece, only because I like to brag to people that I became a farmer because I wanted to be on the front lines of climate change. But it strikes me, not only are you now on the front lines of food security, But you've previously had experience on the front lines of the housing crisis. And I suspect that gives you a perspective on food and food security that is more 360 or holistic than perhaps some of the other people in the sector, although I could be wrong. So give us a sense of kind of your history of leadership, because I think it runs pretty deep. And explain a little bit how you ended up on this particular side of the sector, or focusing on this particular collection of issues.
Well, my history is one generally for the last 27 years in service in variety of ways in the nonprofit sector, really two, on the housing side and on the food security side, and they're co-related. I think my not to go way back, but I had the awesome privilege of having a grandfather who is the international leader of the Salvation Army. And that infused in me a sense of values and opportunity to be able to give back. I've had the opportunity to work alongside some extraordinary people, whether volunteers or staff, and that has been the motivation for me in my career. The vision of, in the case of Habitat for Humanity, a world without poverty housing. In the case of Daily Bread, a city and a country where we eliminate food insecurity, and those are aspirational goals and visions, and it's wonderful to get to work alongside so many volunteers who make that happen. Today is a part of International Volunteer Week, Appreciation Week. And it's, just after this, I'll have the opportunity to go and thank the volunteers who give so generously to this mission.
Right on, right on. And, as a quick aside for listeners, if you put Jesse Hirsch Salvation Army into Google, I did an interview with one of the leaders of the organization. That's quite fascinating because it is a really interesting and historical organization. So that's a very cool connection. One of the reasons I was eager to talk to you is, when people talk about agriculture and people talk about agri-food, Toronto doesn't always fit into the conversation. And, we are starting to look at food security here on the podcast and talking to different guests. Lori Nicol was on the show a couple of episodes ago. I'm not sure our listeners really understand the dynamics of food insecurity in Toronto and the context for the work that your organization does. So even though Toronto people might take that stuff for granted, give us that big picture view. Give us a sense of not just what you and the organization do, but the unique challenges of Toronto within the Canadian context.
Sure, there's a lot in there. And, a lot of people, you're right, don't think about Toronto in the agricultural sense, but, it doesn't take that long to go back in history where Campbell's Soup, that was made in Toronto. There was a whole lot of processing. We used to have canneries here in the city, and we don't have any of that now. We don't have I don't believe there's a cannery actually, a company making cans in the province of Ontario, let alone the country. I'm not entirely sure. I think we ship our metal down. And so we've really been an integrated economy, and a orange man to the south has told us, that is a security risk, and so we need to regroup on that front. That's on the sort of on the macro sense. On the micro, what's going on in terms of food insecurity is problematic, as I said. So you think about nationally, about 10 million Canadians have some degree of food insecurity. That's out of 40 million. And so that's a problem. The next side of that would be just in the local context, it's about 10% who rely on food banks just in Toronto. When the pandemic started, I was called into the church that I attend, and the minister wanted to give a little prayer. He wanted to this is just when we weren't wearing masks because that they were just saved for those that were in first responders. So I was at the church service, and he said this prayer. And before he said it, he said, if the Daily Bread food bank goes down, 60,000 families won't eat this month. And let's give Neil some encouragement. And that didn't give me encouragement. It had a giant yoke on me when he gave that commissioning.
It's like no pressure.
And Yeah, exactly. And now that number is not 60,000. That number is 330,000. So we've gone from 60,000 to 330,000. We've gone from spending $1.5 million a year on food to some $29 million a year on food. It has been a Herculean effort. The city has come together to be able to deal with it. So again, you know, if you talk about the difficult news, I've given you difficult stats. Well, here's the hopeful side of things. I have hope because the community came together and rallied and is responding to the crisis. I have hope because Canadians are talking about a lack of affordable housing and governments know they now need to respond to it. I have hope because we are starting to illuminate the populace with the fact that if you're on disability in Ontario, you get $1,400 a month and you got to survive on that. You only get $700 if you are still on disability, but you find yourself homeless because the government says, since you're homeless, you're not paying rent, therefore we're going to cut your disability in half. So we are telling more and more Ontarians, more and more Canadians, that there is a fundamental problem. It's a structural failure. But the good news is there are policy alternatives to be able to fix that.
Well, and speaking of the policy alternatives, there's a couple of things there you said that in my own kind of amateur historian mind, I was kind of feeling that the way in which we are connecting the dots presently is kind of unprecedented. Like, we used to treat different policy areas as kind of separate and distinct, but now it feels as if we're starting to look at policy frameworks about how these things all connect together in terms of housing and food and access to employment and community services. So I suspect that you have a particular unique perspective that your position affords you, both in terms of being at the front line, right, of seeing kind of the need and the demand grow to your point of going from like five figures to over 300,000. But to your point, I suspect you're starting to see the solutions. You're starting to see the kind of programs and policies that could make an impact at Please, let us see what you see and let us know what you know and help us infect us with the hope that I'm clearly feeling from you.
Well, I think, first of all, there's no magic solution. It will take a toolbox to be able to build this house that we need to build. And so there are different things that we advocate for. So we worked very hard to advocate for the Canada Disability Benefit. That brought in $200 a month more for people on disability. That makes a profound difference. That might be one or two less visits to the food bank in any given month. So income supports are important. On the housing side of things, think about alcohol and tobacco. You pay 30% of that in a sin tax. Gasoline, same thing. So you're sinning, you're paying 30% to the government in taxes. So you've got that. And then on the housing front, when you build a new house, you pay about 30% in development charges and taxes. And so it's preposterous to me that we think that we are going to push housing forward when we levy the same tax rate for sins than we do for something that is fundamentally a right. So you have the right to housing, but you're paying 30% of tax. You have a right to food. There's no tax on food. You have a right to healthcare. There's no tax there. You have a right to education. There's no tax there. But housing, for some reason, there is. So what we're working on right now is we're going to the federal government. We're saying the people that need it the most could really benefit if their rental payments were tax deductible. And could they get a tax credit there? That would allow them to target low-income families and to make it just about rent, and they'd be able to set something up very quickly that would have a profound impact. There's multiple things. There's inclusionary zoning. There's the reduction of development charges. There's removing the HST on housing, and the government is starting to respond to hopefully lower the prices, and you're starting to see a de-escalation in rental prices. The last thing is, how do we fight precarious employment? So if you think the three things that we got to deal with: affordable housing, income supports, precarious employment. On the third one, it's hard. Right now, we're an integrated global economy. And so, there are individuals who come to the food bank, they've got two or three jobs, they're all part-time. Combined, they have an income that is too rich for any social benefits, but to poor to be able to get by. So they're making choices on rent or hydro, things like that. So these are some of the policy areas that we work in. And what's helpful about it is we're on the front line. We can say who's coming in, why they're coming in, and what they need in order to not have to make use of a charity.
I mean, to your point about to use the kind of pop culture phrase, the rise of the precariat instead of the proletariat, it's interesting how that kind of parallels the workforce and even the kind of culture within agriculture, because there is a similar kind of precarity where people will have multiple jobs or multiple part-time jobs and still not be able to make ends meet. I do feel I'm spending a lot of time on the context, and it happens to be because I'm a big picture kind of guy. The other piece I wanted to ask you, and this is kind of within the context of this larger food insecurity crisis, the concept of a food desert is something that I think where food researchers kind of heard it, know all about it. I think there's a lot of people who've never heard that phrase. And I'm curious how the work of the Daily Bread Food Bank correlates to both the concept and presence of food deserts in the city of Toronto.
Well, food deserts were an area, you know, do you have a grocery store that you can purchase from within sort of walking or easy bus access? And that was certainly a real challenge for a lot of Toronto. That has subsequently changed. I would say that Toronto is a city now where there really aren't food deserts, but there's a lot of people that can't afford to go to the grocery store. Sadly, we now the Daily Bread serves about 200 food programs all across the city of Toronto. You can walk to a food bank now pretty well anywhere in the city of Toronto. And that is telling, and it's shameful.
Shameful in the sense that the presence of hunger is shameful. But without being, gleeful in the face of tragedy, it is nonetheless impressive. And I say this in the sense that, you know, I lived in Toronto between the early 80s and the late 2010s. And the extent to which social programs and community support services have become part of the city fabric changed over my lifetime. Can you give us a sense of the diversity or the way in which all those kind of touch points or community kind of presence, the role that it plays in those communities? Because I agree it's shameful that it exists, but at the same time, you have to acknowledge the gratitude to have that kind of infrastructure available to people.
Yeah, you're right, and I should have clarified that. It's atrocious that we have people who can't afford to buy food in a country that has the wealth that we have. And so there is a real challenge when somebody crosses the threshold of a doorway of a food bank for the very first time. You know, there's shame often attached to that. And we do our utmost to be able to register them and get them in the most low barrier way so that they know that they're doing the right thing for their family and that they're not alone. I remember walking the lineup recently where I saw a person that I knew that worked at one of the media outlets in Toronto. And we said hello, and she was, I think she immediately said, well, this is the reason I need to go. And she gave some rationale. And the rationale that she gave was she talked about what her income was, and it was about $50,000 a year. And you think, $50,000, why are they going to a food bank? Well, here's her math. She's got two kids. She pays about $2,100 in rent. So after $50,000 after taxes, you're 36, pay for your rent, and it works out to roughly $6,000 that you have for the year, $500 a month to be able to pay for food, clothing, and transportation. And the average Canadian eats about $300 a month in food. So she's underwater with her two kids right away. So there's somebody who's done everything right. They went to school, they got a job, they're working hard, they should be able to live the Canadian dream, but they can't because what the rental payments are, versus the income that they've got.
And this is where, not to go on a tangent, but it's kind of relevant. This is where I'm a bit of a radical in that I don't see any problems with free food. The same way I don't see any problems with people paying for food, but I wish we could do something about that stigma, about that shame, because I agree with you, $50,000 in Toronto is pretty tight. Like, the cost of living, not just of Toronto, of a lot of Canadian cities, is incredibly difficult for people to manage, and food should not be part of that equation, right? They should not have to worry about their nutrition so they can have the energy and focus to do those things. We could go on and on about that, where we would both be on the same page. I'm curious to get into the organization, and I don't want to get too much into the nuts and bolts, but I suspect a lot of people, myself included, have some cliches about the way food banks work, or that the way an organization like the Daily Bread Food Bank would work. What are some of the strengths? What are some of the pain points? How does a contemporary food bank or food bank umbrella organization, how does it function? And I guess to lead you in a direction, what are the kind of resources that you guys require that we should be championing, both on a policy level or just on a cultural level?
Okay, so lots in there. So what we do is we try to make sure that everybody who comes to the food bank gets 3 days worth of food once a week. So maximum you can come is once per week, and you can get 3 days worth of food. And we do it in each of the food groups. And so how it works behind the scenes is we've got a forecast about 6 weeks out. Every single visit to every single food bank across the city. And then we have to disperse roughly just under 1 million pounds of food per week. That's how much food is coming in and going out of the Daily Bread Food Bank. And we become more and more sophisticated with that. We use AI to help us in that. And we start purchasing from multiple countries, foods that you can't buy here in Canada, and starting to really lower the pricing on these things. So that is... the sort of the logistics, and it all ends up on shelves all across the city of Toronto. Somebody comes in, they're a family of four, they get 400 points and they shop for the food that they need. No longer is the day where you know, here's a box of food and that's, I hope you enjoy it. And because it's inefficient, it's less, because I don't know about you, but I don't buy, like, that box of food is going to have macaroni and cheese, it's going to have peanut butter, it's going to have tuna. And are you going to have a jar of peanut butter every single week? No. And so this shopping actually allows people to be a lot more rationed on the food that they take. So that's how it works on that front. As I mentioned earlier, we used to spend $1.5 million a year on food. Now it's $29 million. It's a sophisticated supply chain here. And anybody listening, anybody watching this, please, if you're in Toronto, come by the Daily Bread Food Bank. We'll give you a tour. We're very friendly, and we'd love to show you how we logistically make this all happen.
And I want to come back to the logistics, but, you know, you talked about the modeling, the AI side. I mean, I'm curious, just on a metaphorical level, how do you deal with that supply and demand? Because to your point, you're dealing with a very large user base and, you know, planning 6 weeks ahead, while it sounds like not a lot of time, that is a lot of complexity. How do you manage that supply and demand? Because clearly the demand is not necessarily stable. It could be growing. And that makes then securing the supply, to your point of having, let's say, three, you know, meals a week, one visit. Like, how do you manage that? How do you project that? And is that a source of stress, or is that something you guys feel that you're getting better at?
We're getting better at it. We're pretty good about it, I would say. We're usually within 1-2% of forecasted client visits. So that part is good. But do we stress about it? Absolutely. And here's the challenge that we also have. You know, we have generous donors like Etel Pasta. They huge amount of pasta that they give to the Daily Bread Food Bank. With love, they will send an email saying, in 4 days, we'd like to send you a tractor trailer load worth of pasta. And we'll be like, absolutely, that's incredible. And we have to say yes, and we always say yes, but that might have screwed up all of our supply chain work that we were doing six weeks ago. So we're definitely going to say yes to the donation. We're going to make it happen. But it's much more challenging. A lot of people think that the not-for-profit sector is a bunch of, you know, moo-moo-wearing, left-wing, granola-eating, dream-catcher kind of folks. And yes, we're visionary, but at the same time, we have to be more businessy than business, because we've got to figure out things that business doesn't normally do. The cost of goods sold, you buy from your vendors and you make the good and you sell it. We have to do all of that. Plus, we have to deal with the massive changes that where a supplier is saying, here's a bunch of free stuff. That doesn't happen in the for-profit side. And you got to say yes to it. So in the not-for-profit sector, you really do have to have a strong business acumen. And because you're working to do more with less in a much more transparent way with additional governance and oversight.
And to your point, the margin of error is even smaller, right? So where they've got some room to fail in ways that, you know, not only for you as failure have direct human cost, but I think the expectations placed on nonprofits and charities do tend to be much higher than the expectations placed on the private sector. I want to dig a little deeper onto the logistics side, only because... I correct me if I'm wrong, but it I assume that what you've developed is kind of unique. And I don't mean unique necessarily within the agri-food sector, but to your point, you're more of a social enterprise than you are a private enterprise. So give me a sense of not just the expertise in logistics that you guys have had to develop, but what that then makes possible, right? In because you are the Toronto Food Bank and not the North Bay Food Bank in terms of, you know, what that logistics, what that capacity then allows you guys to do as a network, as an organization.
Yeah, it's so we are part of an association. So there's the Food Bank of Calgary and of Vancouver, of Montreal. And so we will share a lot of information so that we're not reinventing the wheel. There's no competition there. And that has been very, very useful. We also, quite frankly, we hire some really outstanding individuals. The woman who heads up our operations, our VP of operations, Heather Valentino, she's wonderful. She's come from Kraft and from Maple Leaf, and she has taken that business acumen. She is a, I don't know, what level of Six Sigma she is. She's probably some ninja warrior level, and that she just knows how to lean out the system brilliantly and do it in a way that volunteers want to be part of it. Here's another peculiarity of what we do. If you think about like coming in and sorting food, this food's been donated to us, we got to sort it. You know, we should have conveyor belts here that just, you know, pack everything and move things around. But we don't do that. And we do a less efficient mechanism. The reason? We charge companies to come in. Right now there's a company here that's paying us some $20,000 for the privilege of doing our work. So our revenue source is a labor inefficiency. That doesn't make any sense at all. We have these peculiarities. We learn from what works and doesn't work. We share it across the province. We share it across the country. And we learn from our counterparts right across Canada.
Well, when you say it doesn't make sense, you mean it doesn't make sense from a larger optimization, but it does make sense from a relationship and a revenue generating perspective.
Yeah, it makes complete sense for us. But if we were a for-profit company, we'd lean it out and we would conveyor belt out the packaged goods. Yeah. And instead, you know, we have many of the same systems, but there's a lot of hands that are moving boxes around that you would say, hey, we could get rid of, you know, 90% of the labor force in this operation. And if you did that, then we wouldn't have any money for the food.
Well, and that kind of opens the question, because you alluded to the kind of, I think you might have used the word volunteer experience, but one assumes that the people who are attracted, who are volunteering, are doing so more than just for the reason of they've got time on their hands. Give me a sense of what the culture that either exists, because it does, or that you guys deliberately cultivate to, you know, create where in an enterprise there'd be a culture maybe because people are showing up for a paycheck. check. But in a social enterprise, there's different motivations and there's different desires in terms of what they get back from the organization.
You're entirely right. Culture is the most important thing that I work on every single day at this organization. Without doubt, it is culture, culture, culture. It's culture, then it's strategy, then it's structure. And so what is that culture that we manifest here? Well, for staff, I want to make sure every staff can say, I have the tools, the autonomy, and the inspiration to do my job. So those are the three things we're going for there. And for the paid and unpaid staff as a whole, I would say we take the mission seriously and not ourselves. It is a really fun place to work. It is, if you were to go out into that production hall right now where that company is, there's probably 70s pop music on. If you go into our warehouse, there's some Nigerian rap, I think, that would be playing. And then if you went into the kitchen, they're sort of like a much more heavy rock kind of. And so they all have their own music that's going on there and jazz in the actual food bank. And so we make it a place where you want to be, where you know you're appreciated. As a result, we have almost no turnover of staff. People want to be here.
Well, and to that point, you know, you kind of answered it, but I wouldn't mind you elaborating a little. I think that there are a lot of leaders who either don't appreciate culture or don't value culture, to your point, as part of their mandate as a leader, as part of their focus of what they want to be institutionalizing. What's your argument? What would you say either to other leaders or even to your stakeholders who might say, you know, Neil, why are you prioritizing culture above and beyond some of your other responsibilities?
I think it'd be hard to find somebody who doesn't think that the CEO's job is to instill a good culture for the organization that they run. But you know, my arguments for it would simply be it's in your best interest. When somebody wants to be there, they do that job with excellence. When somebody is valued, there is a sense of collegiality that is incredibly important. And I want people to want to be here. People need to get it, want it, and have the capacity to do their job. And I'm going to make sure that they have the three things: the tools, the autonomy, and the inspiration. And then on that autonomy, we let them fly. And so it costs us a lot less because we have a lot less turnover. It allows us to attract great people. That's another thing. You know, we posted for a board position. So we had two board positions last year. And so these are unpaid positions to be on our board of directors. We did the posting for, let's call it 3-4 weeks. And there were 300 applications, qualified applications for the position. And that speaks volumes to people wanting to be here. And so when you are that magnet, good things happen. So what has happened, because of a good culture, we've gone from $8 million a year in revenue to $42 million a year in revenue. It has been solid, good growth. The risk associated with a toxic culture, I just think, is far too great to avoid not putting it as precedent.
And this is where, part of the reason I asked the question the way I did about culture is I think you are kind of taking your own exceptionality for granted in that, you know, toxic cultures are quite pervasive right now in our organizations, in our broader economy. And there are very few leaders with the courage and leadership that you have to not only not want them, but to recognize the burden and dysfunction they place upon the organization. And there's a reason why I keep evoking the phrase social enterprise, because I do think that you guys legitimately belong in the category of enterprise, not just because you have the size and the capability, but to your point about the five sigmas or whatever, you are achieving a level of excellence that we often just associate with enterprises. Yet at the same time, you use the word, which I want to emphasize because it's a word I think about a lot, autonomy. There are very few enterprises who even understand what autonomy is, let alone encourage their staff or their leaders to embrace autonomy. Why is it so important to you? And what has been the rewards or the payoffs for embracing such an approach?
There's study after study that tells you that when people are under stress, they make bad decisions. So what do you do as a boss, as an employer? You remove as much stress as you possibly can on your workforce. So when you do that, people make better decisions and they are more productive. And it's as simple as that. It doesn't have to be over complicated. And so that has been my primary function, is to make sure that this is a culture where people want to be.
And again, to your credit, that requires a lot of confidence, a certain level of self-esteem that not all leaders have. So I appreciate that. And then let me follow that up with a much more difficult question to put you in a more awkward or flat-footed position. What do you think the rest of us are missing? Right? What is it, like, a lot of what we've talked about so far, while maybe not familiar to outsiders, I think people within the sector kind of understand the value of, and that's partly why I was getting into the autonomy piece and the culture piece, because I do think there are segments that don't appreciate that. But what are the pieces that maybe you take for granted, or maybe that you're really passionate about, but you feel the rest of society is kind of clueless about? Again, it's a tough question to kind of catch you off guard, but I'm really trying to draw out that piece of wisdom, that thing that you see that you wish the rest of us could see that would either make your job easier or, on a broader social level, would really start to reverse the food insecurity crisis that we're witnessing.
Oh, man. Like, there's so many questions within that. Like, that's almost not fair.
I don't play fair.
I'll parse it out. First, on the leadership side of things. Leadership can be incredibly lonely. It is, you know, you as CEO, you don't have a peer. The board chair is not your peer. He represents the boss, and anybody who's a staff member is, you know, theoretically reporting up. So being a leader can be incredibly lonely. More than that, a leader always has to be rowing in the opposite direction of the team. So when they're chaotic, you are calm. When they are calm, you are the one stirring things up. And so that makes that loneliness even greater. So you do need to have a sense of confidence about that. But you get that confidence, I would argue, by hiring people better than you. I can, you know, if you play tennis, you should never play tennis with somebody who's not as good, or you always play tennis with somebody better if you want to get better. And so I can say with full confidence, every single one of the leadership team does their functional area far better than I could ever do. And so that's an enormous burden lifted from me, right? So now I've got, I've got this lonely position. I've got the stressor and that burden, but it's reduced because I'm playing tennis with people better than me. So that's on the leadership side of things. And then on the what don't people get right now about food insecurity, what they don't get is how costly poverty is. There was a study in 2019 that showed that poverty costs about $30 billion in Ontario alone per year. In Ontario alone, about $1.7 billion in the justice system, about $5 billion in healthcare costs directly attributable to poverty. So we have as Canadians a choice of addressing poverty upstream by building affordable housing, by building cooperatives, by building social housing, and making sure that people's stress in life is reduced because they can afford to live and thrive in their community. And as a result, it will actually increase what we have to spend on debt reduction, on other priorities that the government might have. Poverty is expensive. And then the last part is poverty is expensive on our souls. It is incredibly expensive to think about every time you walk down the street and see a person who's unhoused at the time. And, you know, do I talk to them? Do I not? How are they doing? They've been there month after month, year after year. And it can be as taxing and as horrific it is for that person living that experience. It's also traumatic for the child that walks by and says, what's going on there? And so there is a real opportunity to reduce our government spend by doing the right moral thing and going upstream in poverty.
Right on. Now, we're almost at the end of what has been a wonderful episode, and I kind of have to ask this next question. I'm not sure if you feel it will be tangential or still within the kind of wheelhouse of what we've been discussing, but there's lots of talk these days about municipal grocery stores, and certainly the city of Toronto is actively exploring it. What are your thoughts, both on the concept, but also the impact that it could have?
Well, I'll say that... as it is right now, I'm not in favor of them. And I've got to preface that by saying I appreciate so much a city council that declared a state of emergency when it came to food insecurity that's willing to try anything. Mm-hmm. But to try anything means you do your homework. And so let's just do the homework really quickly together. You spend about $300 a month in groceries. So the grocery stores get a profit of about 2.5 to 4%. So if the city came in and said, we're going to do it without profit, and they were able to deliver, that'll be about $12 for you. But here's the big but. That makes a wild and wrong assumption that the city could operate as efficiently as Loblaws, and that the city could buy food as cheaply as Loblaws. So that ain't going to happen. So then the question becomes, how much of a subsidy should the city be putting in? So if they want to help you, and is it $25, is it $50 per month? Now, if you do $50 per month and you just use the people that go to the food bank, that would cost about $15 million per month for the city to give that $50 subsy to each person that's going there. And then you'd have questions about, well, could anybody shop there and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, where I think the city can be most effective is providing land for development for affordable housing. They can reduce development charges. They can provide the student nutrition program for breakfast and in school boards across the city of Toronto. So I don't think city-run grocery stores are anything other than a fleeting headline. But here's the thing. Thank you to the city for bringing it up as an idea. Daily Bread will do the homework and the math to find out whether or not the math maths or not. And if it doesn't, don't do it. Because there's enormous tail risk if you do it and it fails. So let's play that one through. So they put the four stores out there. That's what they're looking at right now. And they fail. Now, Joe Average walking down the street is going to say, yeah, the government tried to do something. The government can't do it. And it'll affect all other progressive social policies. And so don't do something that, you know, is outside your lane that does not necessarily have that opportunity for success.
Well, and, you know, to your larger point, I thought of this question when we were talking about the logistics and infrastructure, because you clearly understand some of the difficulties and the pain points in managing that. And to your larger point, that it's not as if a startup from the public sector is going to beat Loblaws at their own game without heavy subsidies. And I fully agree that the danger here is when they mess it up, not so much when they're presenting the idea. One last question before we get to the closer. How do you guys plan to capitalize on this larger awareness around food security? Because this kind of goes back to our larger question about shame, that on the one hand, yes, food insecurity is getting worse, and that's putting a lot of stress on people. But I do see the silver lining that more and more people are upset about these issues and perhaps more mobilized to look at the adjacent policy areas that you've been bringing up. To go to end on the hope note, what do you think the opportunity is now for you as a leader and for your organization?
You're entirely right. And this is I'm glad that we're ending on this. Not the question two questions ago. That was a hard one. On this point, we have the power to change policy. So we got some 280,000 letters sent to Chrystia Freeland to get the Canada Disability Benefit. Why? Because Torontonians and Canadians saw that it was fundamentally wrong that anybody should be on disability and not be able to afford their groceries. And so there was pressure put on. So we will leverage the media that is out there, podcasts, whether it's traditional or social, no matter what it is, we're going to leverage that to infuse a sense of activism that allows us to be able to have conversations based on evidence, and based on good data, to be able to provide policy solutions. Because, you know, I work with all politicians, and I can tell you, and I'm not affiliated with any of them, I can tell you that it doesn't matter if it's, you know, like left, center, right, all of them, whether they like to admit it or not, of the other parties, all of them want a Canada where everybody can thrive in community. They just have different ways of getting there. And so we're going to make sure that based on the government that's in place and their priorities, that we provide them the policy alternatives that will make sure that we can all thrive.
Right on. So we are out of time. The last part of every episode is the shout outs. And this is really meant to be a kind of gut feeling where I say to you, hey, Neil, who are the leaders that you look up to? Who are the people that you either look for inspiration or that we should be looking to? And it's meant to be a spontaneous answer. I'm not looking for an Academy Awards acceptance speech or anything. Just who comes to mind?
All right. Well, I'm gonna give you a few. So the past leaders that I look up to and I got to be mentored by would certainly be President Jimmy Carter, Ed Clark, the former CEO of TD Bank. He's still living. I made it sound like past. And the founder of Habitat for Humanity, Millard Fuller. Those are incredible leaders who grew their organizations or in politics, and they did it with a sense of value and hard work. And then current leaders, I'm heading right now to thank volunteers, and those volunteers are assembled and brought together by Jeffrey Wong and his team here at Daily Bread, and I'm going to give him a shout out, because in this International Week of Volunteers, corralling that group, inspiring that group, that's a mighty task that Jeff has, so he's getting my shout out.
Right on. Right on. Well done. Well, thank you, Neil. This has been fantastic. And if anything, has really helped me appreciate the expertise that social enterprises like the Toronto Daily Bread Food Bank and leaders like yourself are developing, if only because, you know, to your point about the association that you're in, so we can spread and cross-pollinate that knowledge as widely as possible. So thanks again for a fantastic conversation.
Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
It's certainly tempting to admire the system after a conversation like that and admire a leader like Neil and the resilience and capacity that he brings to the heroic challenge of feeding the hungry, certainly in a city like Toronto. But we can't stop there, because what Neil and his team have built is by any operational measure extraordinary. The scale, the coordination, the ability to anticipate need and respond to it. It's a model many institutions would struggle to match. You can see why food banks have become indispensable. But that's not the point that we should be leaving this conversation with. The deeper takeaway is harder to sit with. The more effective this infrastructure becomes, the easier it is for broader systems to lean on it, to defer responsibility, to accept that this is how things work now. And yet, inside that reality, there is a different kind of signal. Culture, doing real work, heavy lifting. Dignity preserved through design, not intention. Volunteers and staff acting with a shared sense of purpose that holds the whole kit and caboodle together. A system that, even under pressure, insists on treating people as participants, not problems. Imagine if we had a democracy like that, eh? So the question isn't whether food banks should exist. They already do. They're embedded, evolving, and in many ways leading. The question is what we choose to learn from them. Do we treat this as a permanent workaround? Or do we recognize it as a map? One that shows us exactly where our policies, our markets, and our assumptions are breaking down. Because if this is infrastructure now, then it's telling us something. Not just about food, but about how we care for each other at scale. And that is, fundamentally, the ideology of the future herd. We gotta care for each other, eh? All right, until next time, we'll see you soon.